We're discussing the future of farming and takeaways from Farm Technology Days that wrapped up in Eau Claire. Did you go? Showcasing the latest advancements in agriculture. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin State Farmer says tens of thousands of people turned out, including Governor Evers, who tweeted afterward that the three-day event is a proud tradition in our state. Farmers, what tech innovations have you found most useful? Which ones have caused more headache and stress? 800-642-1234. Ernie Jennerman is general manager of Wisconsin Farm Technology Days. His roots run deep in ag, growing up on a Wisconsin dairy farm with memories of going to what was then called Farm Progress Days. Ernie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Matt Gluin is here, outgoing show manager and former UW Extension ag agent for decades. Matt, welcome to you.
Well, good morning. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, Matt. Let's start with you. You had hundreds of commercial demonstrations by vendors, educational exhibits. Can you give us a sense of what Farm Tech Days was like?
Well, I think it would be kind of difficult to even imagine if you hadn't attended. We have over 500 exhibitors spread out over about a 70-acre area. A lot of them are outside. Some of them are under tents. And they're there exhibiting their products that are just every imaginable input that farmers would use in their crop and livestock production programs.
So every imaginable input, basically every type of product or tractor or any implement that you would have on your operating on your farm, you were able to kind of see it up close.
That's right. But it goes well beyond that because a lot of the products are biological innovation, not only mechanical or engineering type of things. A lot of the things make life easier, make the farmers more productive. So there's a vast array. And then we've got also the human side of agriculture, the business side, the farm management consultants, the agronomists, accountants that all provide services or assistance to the producers.
Yeah, it's a business after all. Ernie, you know, with COVID last year, what was this comeback like for you?
Well, one of the things that I think we need to note is as many industries, ag industry did not shut down during COVID. Cows needed to be milked every day, and the crops were put in and crops were cared for and harvested. So in the ag world, it was a difficult time because all the same concerns everybody else had about family health and supply chain issues have been a big factor. But the work went on, and it was a demanding year. So I think this it was good to have the show this year because the development of technology continued as well, and farmers and farms evolved and their needs evolved. And so it was good to get an opportunity to showcase those technology again, and then to connect with people. This show was it was kind of like a coming out party because the folks have not been able to meet face to face for a good part of a year or more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they took that opportunity. And the show is an opportunity to see new technology. It's also an opportunity to connect with customers. And that was one of the things I heard as I talked to vendors is, not only were they meeting new people and seeing people that had new interests and needs, but they also were able to reconnect with existing customers. And, and that's important to the whole process because that feedback on how things work, that all enters into, the process going forward.
And the decisions you make. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. So I think it was a great opportunity for people to get out and see each other again. And so it was something that everybody looked forward to. And, we were fortunate to have, three great days.
We're talking with Arnie Jennerman and Matt Gluin. They manage the Wisconsin Farm Technology Days as we get a recap and a window into farming advancements. With your thoughts, are you a farmer? What technological innovations have you found most useful? What tech out there is maybe not so useful to you or that needs to evolve further? 800-642-1234. Arnie, picking up on something you said there, one of the issues on a dairy farm is the cows never stop milking, right? So you can never really take time off unless you have someone to do the milking for you. How has technology progressed in milking?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think that we hear this all the time, you know, have to be big to survive. And, you know, the interesting thing about Wisconsin agriculture and especially dairying, if you look around, there's still a wide array of sizes of farms. And somewhere along the continuum, farmers have to make a decision of how much outside help they're going to depend on. You know, can they operate with their family alone, or do they, do they have to get into the business of, you know, hiring help and dealing with all the complexities that go with that? And so that's one area where, especially in dairying, you've seen some of the automation with robotics, where a family can possibly handle a larger herd and still have occasionally have some time off. So I think in dairying especially, we've seen those decisions, on technology become part of the family decision. You know, who's going to run the farm, and can we make the investment? Should we make the investment? And, you know, what kind of lifestyle do we want to have? And sometimes that's really important to the decision of the next generation to stay on the farm. You know, they see the 7 day a week, 24/7/365 kind of lifestyle that farmers have had traditionally. And, you know, they see other opportunities. And if you can apply technology and make the operation, more livable and
improve quality of life,
family environment, quality of life, get away once in a while, I think that enters into the decision as well, as does the cost, of course, and, you know, what it can do to your operation.
Yeah. So, Matt, what do you see there? And, you know, I'm curious, with labor shortages on the farm, what have you seen by way of driverless tractors? Are they coming online in the near future?
Well, with the advent of the incredible accuracy with GPS and then marrying that to computer systems, we're able to do all kinds of things out in the field, from, you know, driverless tractors that get a lot of publicity. But the big thing we can do now is, instead of treating a 40-acre field all the same, we can measure production.
Hey, Matt, we're having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. So I don't know if it's an issue of just speaking more clearly into the phone, but we're having just a little bit of tech issues on our end. Go ahead.
Sure, I'll try to do that.
Yeah, there we go.
A little closer. So anyway, they can measure productivity in different parts of the field and then apply inputs at different levels, which not only reduces cost, increases production, but helps protect the environment. So if we don't have to apply additional amounts of fertilizer to parts of the field that don't require it, that, you know, like I said, reduces cost and protects the environment. And that's kind of what technology does in general for many parts of agriculture.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, though, the risk and reward here, because you sink all this money and debt into that technology or that tractor, that combine, that sprayer, and you got the precision, you know, seeders and the satellite guided accuracy to an inch, maybe less. But does it improve your yield? Is the cost benefit there?
Oh, I'm sure it does. In just about every case, farmers, if they're still farming, have become very astute on the financial side of things and very careful with their dollars. So for the most part, they wouldn't be investing in this technology if it wasn't beneficial to them, if it wasn't beneficial to the environment. And some of the technology that comes out may have a very short life, or some has, simply because it didn't produce the kind of production and financial returns that it was touted to do. And so farmers are pretty quick to drop that kind of technology.
Ernie, can you put that in perspective? What are the technology costs associated with a small to medium sized farm?
Well, if you look at some of the machinery that was at the show, there's really a wide range depending on capacity and features. But, you know, it's not too hard this day and age to spend $500,000 on a combine or more, and on a tractor. So those are huge investments. And, those have to be made back, 100 pounds of milk at a time or a bushel of corn at a time. So you really have to, have a pretty sharp pencil to work that out, make sure it pencils out. before you make those investments. And as Matt said, you know, we're buying this equipment, it has to last for a period of time, it has to work in our operation. And I think that's the other thing that is, I think, noteworthy of the show, and I think noteworthy of how marketing to agriculture works. We see the technology, but we really want to know how it's going to work in our operation, because the farm is very, it's kind of, you see one farm, you've seen one farm. There's similarities, but there's also a lot of differences in soils. There's differences in the rest of the system, because this all has to fit into a system that the farmer has. Matt mentioned the precision agriculture. On the one hand, you have the application of fertilizer and pesticides and, you know, crop protection products. But the other side of that is you need the equipment on your combine, for example, to measure yield right down to a spot in the field.
So
when you make the investment in the crop protection application, you also have to have the inputs, the data to drive that equipment.
It's a chain of events. Want to pause right there, Ernie. Ernie Jennerman, who is the incoming general manager of Wisconsin Farm Technology Days. Matt Gluin here as well has been general manager of the event for nearly a decade. Do you work in ag? How have things changed since you started? What improvements would you like to be made in the field? Has technology made dairy farming in particular more efficient? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the latest in farm technology and equipment and the wrap-up of Farm Technology Days in Eau Claire. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Thousands of people converged on the Chippewa Valley to commune, to hear from area farmers and vendors, to share their processes. Did you go to Farm Tech Days? What did you learn? What technology advancements have been a game changer for your farming operations? 800-642-1234. Ernie Jennerman and Matt Gluin, they're with Farm Tech Days, and they stay with us. So, Matt, with so much technology, I would imagine it could be really hard to keep track of the latest developments and the latest products. How does Farm Tech Days help to simplify that process for farmers?
Well, obviously, we all have the internet available to us, and most farmers, I think, are actively pursuing information and technology on the internet. But it's so much easier and probably so much more fun to just walk the streets at Farm Tech Days and kind of have it presented to you in a way that makes sense, is easy to digest, and so. That's why farmers attend Farm Tech Days, is because it's just it's a lot easier than searching it all out on their own.
I would imagine, too, talking with a vendor face-to-face, you would, A, develop a relationship, and, B, you can ask your questions on the spot.
Right. It's just a whole lot easier, particularly if the technology isn't new or familiar to you. Getting some explanation. Of course, you know, you probably get a little sales pitch with that too, so you have to be able to sort that all out. But but I think farmers typically enjoy the face-to-face interactions with vendors at the show.
Ernie, I want to touch on the right to repair movement and the pushback against manufacturers that limit who can repair the equipment, right? As you know, some companies that make farm equipment only allow repairs at their own dealerships. And that could be changing under the Federal Trade Commission and President Biden. But what do you hear from first farmers on this issue?
Well, I think, you know, it would be similar to, you know, if you had those kind of limits on your car. I think it's a complex issue, and there certainly are two sides of it. And of course, you know, you're going to hear the kind of horror stories from both sides. So I think we need to take a balanced approach when we look at something like that. On the one hand, I think the manufacturers, and I haven't talked to them in great detail on the issue, but they've invested in the technology, and they also are concerned about its proper use and the protection of the technology, just as anybody in that field would be. So we have to be a little careful that we don't have a negative impact on the motivation for them to introduce technology. So we want to continue to see technology coming into our products. On the other hand, you know, the maintenance of that is expensive, and you know, the free, anytime you tell somebody you can do something, we react to that. So I think if you buy a piece of equipment, you spend $500,000 on it, you think you own it, and somebody says, no, you can't open that up and fix it on your own, that I think is a concern too. So I think I would suggest that we need to take a balanced approach, and whatever we come up with, be careful that we don't hinder the ability to see the new technology, to have, make it available. At the same time, we need to be concerned with the cost and also the timeliness of being able to repair and keep things in operation. So I think it's, as with any of those issues, it's a very complex issue. And I from my perspective, with the ag industry, we want to, you know, make sure we keep seeing technology and we keep motivating manufacturers to make it available. But we need to make sure it's cost effective and we have the flexibility to use it in our systems. So I think I would kind of leave it at that. It's a very complicated issue, and then we'll be watching it closely, as many will on all from all perspectives.
Matt, weigh in here. What do farmers do when a piece of equipment breaks down?
Well, unfortunately, just like Ernie mentioned with our cars, a lot of the technology has made repair beyond even somebody with pretty good basic skills. So it's kind of a catch-22. You want the technology, you want to have it available and use it, but then there are the issues with dealing with maintenance and repair. And you know, you mentioned one that's kind of been on the burner now for a little while.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, from your perspective, then, would the right to repair movement benefit local farmers, or how do you walk that line with manufacturers?
Well, obviously, you know, you want to, like Ernie said, timeliness and cost is all factors in allowing farmers to repair. And there's just a wide spectrum of ability among farmers to maintain and repair things. So it wouldn't be an issue if there weren't some real big, difficult questions involved.
Yeah. We're talking with Mac Lewin and Ernie Jennerman. They manage the Wisconsin Farm Technology Days. Taking your questions about farming into the future as well at 800-642-1234. You know, Ernie, one of the issues in farming is what happens with the next generation and passing these farms down, and what if the kids don't want to run the farm? You know, what are you seeing there in terms of education about farming, that it is a career option, and that, you know, and attracting young people to the profession?
Well, that's a great question, and I think the folks at the Eau Claire show did a great job of showcasing the various career opportunities in agriculture and surrounding agriculture. I think when we think about agriculture, it's not just the farms, it's everything that goes into supporting them, and, you know, the products going in and the products coming out. So there are just a lot of career opportunities associated with agriculture, and not all of them are right on the farm. We have a lot of support efforts, and, you know, many of the things we've just talked about, and all that technical equipment needs to be understood and be able to repair and integrate is the other factor. Just as with your home computer, the software has to work. So there's a lot of career opportunities in agriculture, and that's one of the things we like to feature at Farm Technology Days, to get future generations of young folks that are on farms or involved in agriculture, and those that aren't, to understand what those opportunities are. But that's going to be ongoing. And as with all technology, it changes. So it's going to be an ongoing learning process for everybody in the industry. So that really was one of the focuses at Farm Technology Days. And then the other thing I heard from farmers and heard from vendors is just the challenges getting staff, getting trained staff to work with the technology and work in their businesses. So there's just tremendous opportunities in the field, and I think that's going to be ongoing. So I hope we convince some young folks at the show in Eau Claire to consider agriculture and the surrounding industries as a career opportunity.
Matt, final thoughts there on career opportunities and your takeaways from Farm Tech Days.
Well, you know, I've been around agriculture now for 40 plus years, and I can remember when young people were kind of discouraged by their parents and others about being involved in agriculture. I just see the opposite now. I see young people going back to their family farms and lots of opportunity for them. I see them, as Arnie mentioned, going into the support areas, the support technology. So it's changed a lot in the last years, and it's a wide open career field today.
Well, Matt, thank you for joining us. And Arnie, thank you as well. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much, Kate. Thanks for having us on.
Arnie,
yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Matt Gluin there, who is the outgoing manager for Wisconsin Farm Technology Days. Arnie Jennerman, the general manager. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a newspaper vendor.
More than 20,000 people in Wisconsin experience homelessness. That's according to a 2019 report from the Institute for Community Alliances. Among those are vendors for Street Pulse Newspaper, a Dane County publication whose mission is to amplify the voices of individuals experiencing homelessness and encourage advocacy in the community. WPR's Alyssa Alamand introduces us to one of the Street Pulse vendors.
Whenever I go to Trader Joe's, there are three things always on my grocery list: matcha ice cream, a couple boxes of chicken tikka masala, and a copy of Street Pulse newspaper. If you, too, are a frequent Trader Joe's shopper on Madison's west side, you may have noticed Chris Hubbard, a vendor for Street Pulse, who spends his days selling newspapers.
Well, it's been an easier winter so far, so pretty lucky.
Hubbard has been experiencing homelessness for 10 years. Before that, he worked in the Capital Newspaper's press room, which happens to be where issues of Street Pulse are printed. Hubbard says it's hard to find employment after losing a job because once something is on your record, it's there for all future employers to see. But with Street Pulse...
Well, the Pulse was the only job that all I had to do was walk in and shake a guy's hand and I was hired, like the olden days. So the first couple years I was like some of the other homeless, like sitting on the bench all day, not really doing anything, hanging out at the library. So this was doing something, you know, not real hard work, just holding a paper and hoping someone will buy a couple, you know.
Thank you. Karen Andrew is the former editor-in-chief of the newspaper and former president of the Street Pulse Board of Directors.
The topic of homelessness is so diverse and complex. It isn't one issue, not a cookie-cutter problem, and it's not a cookie-cutter solution. What I'm hopeful about is in Madison and Dane County, in our continuum of care, I'm seeing very big changes in representation of individuals who are sharing voice at the policy level, people's experience of barriers.
Street Pulse is run by volunteers. Vendors purchase newspapers for 50 cents per copy to then sell the issues around Madison. Their income is the tips they make from selling the papers. The suggested donation from the public is $1 per copy, but any amount is welcome. Like most things, the pandemic has had an impact on Street Pulse.
Yeah, the COVID thing, it did mess the job up, but hopefully we all survive it and go back to what we were doing before.
Joel Gerard is the current president of Street Pulse's board of directors and lead guest service specialist at The Beacon, a resource center for people without homes in Madison. He says capacity restrictions at businesses has been the hardest part of the pandemic for Street Pulse vendors. They aren't always allowed to sell on businesses' property because they would count as one of their guests. Another obstacle, both amid the pandemic and prior, is having enough writers to fill an issue of the newspaper.
So we used to do them monthly, but we're just not having the articles to write right now and the writers, but that's kind of been a big draw too. You know, no one wants to buy a paper that only has like two pages.
Back at Trader Joe's, Hubbard is having a good sales day. When he doesn't have newspapers to sell, he relies on photography prints to bring in some cash.
Oh yeah, the duck photos are been really popular this morning. White morning glory flower, got a lot of them out.
The backs of the photos all say the same: stay happy, smiley face, from Chris Hubbard.
You know, I don't have to have every refrigerator in Wisconsin have my photo, but that would be kind of my ego then would increase with if every house. And
well, there are, I think I have three of your photos on my fridge.
Ah, great.
So you got me.
Some people may want the paper, some people may want just a photo. And then I like to make keep everybody happy and maximize my money too at the same time.
And with that money, he tries to take a trip every year to visit his mother in Florida, which he said is an opportunity to relax, compensate for Wisconsin winters, and shower twice a day.
WPR's Alyssa Allemand brought us that story on Street Pulse newspaper. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the tragic history of Indigenous boarding schools. From the 1800s all the way into the 1960s, hundreds of thousands of Native American children were removed from their homes and families, stripped of their culture, and placed in boarding schools run by the federal government and churches. This trauma is detailed by the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition in Minneapolis. What do you think of the federal government's initiative to explore the legacy of these schools and search the grounds of former facilities? What do you hope will come out of it? 800-642-1234. Sasa Nasa Jennings is the Native American Student Success Coordinator for the UW system. She's a member of the Menominee Nation. Sasa Nasa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So we've been seeing the news reports over the past couple of months, the remains of as many as 1,000 Native American children found at former boarding schools in Canada, remains also found at a school in Pennsylvania. How is this news that's unfolding affecting you personally?
It's bittersweet, right? Like it's a very complicated subject. I'm glad that the young ones and the young ancestors that went on too soon are being returned to their communities and hopefully having a ceremony that they needed to have a long time ago. But it also, you know, shows the tragic history of our nations and how our Native people were treated. And so, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with really reconciling what that means, but also giving space to those communities to be able to grieve and make sure their ancestors are being laid to rest in an appropriate manner. But, you know, recognizing that, you know, we have a tragic, dark history, and how do we move forward without repeating those steps?
You grew up on the Menominee Reservation where a boarding school existed. How did your family and friends talk about these schools? How did you view them when you were growing up?
You know, we do have a Catholic church that is here. My grandpas and grandmothers talked about it, but they never talked about some of the things, you know, really that happened. You know, I was mentioning to your producer that there was a news segment done on our tribal nation that talks about some of the unmarked graves that are here. And it just, you know, gives you some type of perspective, right, of what our ancestors had endured, and really thinking about how do we treat those who have been through that. But also, how do we work with our families to help reconcile what their family members have been through? And so, you know, there's always rumblings of, you know, people who attended or this is kind of what they did, but there was never a lot of talk about it. I know my grandmother, her grandmother, her mother, she spoke Menominee, but I'm not sure if, you know, attending the boarding school really deterred her from speaking more to us. She had words here and there that she would speak, but really just, you know, trying to understand what our ancestors went through and why it's gotten us here in our communities now.
Yeah. So it sounds like the the trauma is passed from one generation to the next, and there's still so much mystery that remains around it. Do you know if there are remains located near Wisconsin's former boarding schools?
That I'm not quite sure, right? I'm not a historian or archaeologist person, but I do, know that if things had happened the way things are playing out in the rest of the other communities, as well as the other boarding schools, there's a high probability of it could have happened, right? Mm-hmm. We don't know why and how these people who are running the boarding schools, what their mentality was. We can guess, and really think about, why they were trying to cover up some of these things. But, I would guess, personally would say, I think there's a high probability that there are. And we need to make sure that we give our communities time to grieve and space to do that, but also help to recognize why this is such an important and really long foreseen issue that we are uncovering. And, it took us how many years to really think about these young ancestors who went on too soon, but also, what impact that had on the communities. And, we strive to be resilient, and we are continuing to be resilient. Our communities are working with our youth, our communities are working on their language and culture, but really thinking about, why we had to get to where we are now, and helping our communities do that in a good way.
Sasanisa, one of the images that was posted in an article that was just so heart-wrenching was this encampment across the road from a boarding school, because the parents weren't allowed to see their children, and it was their only ability to see a glimpse of their children. How does the damage carry on? How does that damage endure?
When we think about, right, we think about the main policies that were put in place at that time was this idea to remove these young ones from their community in order to assimilate them into being American, right? Mm. And so this idea of removal and stripping them of what they know to be home and what they know to be love and what they know to be who they are, I think that's really telling, right? Mm-hmm. Is that we're not letting our young ones have their parents and their loved ones be a part of who they are as they grow up. We're stripping them and removing them. And so, a lot of the things that I think about is how we do that today and what that looks like today and what are some of the things and practices that we maybe not understand or think about, but how do we continue to do that and not make that mistake, right? Mm-hmm. And not be 50 years down the road and have a similar picture.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about that work today. We have Sasanisa Jennings, Native American Student Success Coordinator for the UW system. And in her work, she talks with tribal leaders and elders and students to hear about their experiences and how to create a more supportive environment for Native students on campuses across the state. You can join in 800-642-1234. What is not understood about Native American culture in the academics setting? We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal government is investigating the troubled legacy of U.S. policies related to Native American boarding schools and searching the grounds of these former facilities that lasted over a century. According to the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, hundreds of these schools operated in 29 states, including here in Wisconsin. Sasanisa Jennings is Native American Student Success Coordinator for the UW-Wisconsin system, liaison between Wisconsin First Nations and the system. She's with us for 10 more minutes. Your research has looked at the legacy of these Native American boarding schools on higher ed today, and I'm wondering if you can make some of those connections to us. What similarities do you see between the boarding schools and our current education system as it exists today?
Yeah, when you're doing your research, it kind of develops how it needs to be. And that's one of the things. I didn't go into my research really thinking about these things. It kind of came out as I was doing it, really looking at the policies of the 19th and 20th century around education and citizenship, and really what those policies were looking at was this idea of assimilation, right, and acculturation for Native people. And a part of that, you know, not to go too deep to about it, but this idea of the settler colonialism and how as we as Native people needed to be erased in a particular way in order for settler colonialism to be successful, along with the enslavement of other folks, particularly Black folks. And so really one of the ways, right, outside of actually mass genocide, was to use education as this tool of social control. And a part of that was removing our young ones from their communities, right, getting them away from the languages, the cultures, the very essence of who they were, to Americanize them, right? Mm-hmm. and so that removal and that assimilation were the two big things that I was looking at and seeing how as an American higher education public, I want to make sure we're looking at the right public institution, how we continue to do that. And this idea of removal is very strong, right? We think about our students have to be removed from our communities, whether it be a reservation community, whether it be an urban community, a suburban community, they need to be removed to go to these institutions to learn these things that what we deem the American public as successful in order to be a successful person, right? It's a very similar parallel idea. And as in this idea of assimilation too, there's an idea and there's a way of what we think and how we do school, I put that in quotations, how we understand to be a student. And oftentimes that can be at very contrast to who we are as Native people. So our students need to really navigate what those situations are. And sometimes, you know, having to be in school when particular ceremonies are happening or during harvest season and having to pick, right, are they going to be in school during these times or are they going to go home? And then think about what those consequences are.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. Maddie is joining us from De Pere. Hi, Maddie.
Hello.
Hi. You're a member of the Oneida tribe.
That's correct. And I wondered if your guests had ever heard, I heard on your station, the story was read of, I think it was Little Hawk and something or another. But what it was memoir of Raymond Cockatosh. And from what I understand, it was such an interesting story. I wanted to purchase a CD of it. They got it from the Wisconsin Veterans Historical thing, mm-hmm. and I was not able to purchase a CD of that story. And also, I interviewed and recorded several of the Oneida people who went to the boarding school. In our case, it was not forced. And the parents or grandparents made the decision whether the children would go to the boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
So
you have those interviews, Mandy. What did you learn from the interviews?
Well, like I said, they were not forced.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was decision, you know, it was because the parents knew that the children had to learn how to speak English. Many of them, by the time they were 10 or 12 years old, they didn't know a word of English. And it was not easy, you know, yeah. because none of us would want to go from home to some strange place among people we didn't understand and their language.
Well, Sasanesa, I want to jump in here and allow you to talk about the importance of taking down this history and doing these first-person interviews.
Yeah, thank you, Maddie, for bringing that up. That it's also, you know, I have a friend in Alaska who talks about this, like the her experience of boarding schools was not as negative. And so we need to also look at the holistic view of what these brought forward, right? And why parents may have wanted to send their students to these institutions. I think it's very important to have all sides recognized. Really thinking about, you know, those who had maybe a more positive experience, but those who also maybe had a negative experience, because I think it's a similar parallel to what happens here in our higher ed institutions, right? Some students may enjoy their time there and, you know, not feel the tension and not feel the very dissonance of what comes with coming to higher ed institution, but some may. And I think, you know, we're not all the same. We come from all different nations. And I think it's very important to recognize that we all have different experiences, but really thinking about the holistic experience that we're providing. One that was provided at these boarding schools, but also at higher ed institutions.
I want to just spend the last moments here on looking for some solutions. I mean, you've had a role in tribal consultation policies for the UW to honor sovereignty. And I'm wondering, how can campuses develop better relationships?
It's, you know, any relationship takes time, right? Takes time and takes energy and real, this genuine want and desire to be in collaboration with these nations. And I think, you know, just being open and just really understanding that some of the policies and practices that we may have done up until this point may not be what the tribal nations want. And we need to be okay with that, right? We need to be okay with shifting our institution to be able to make it just as flexible for our students and our tribal nations to be a part of this process. And be in collaboration with them, and really working with our tribal nations and understanding that, you know, education is really one small kind of entity that they have to deal with on a daily basis. And how can we work all together to be successful and to create successful institutions for our students and our faculty and our staff moving forward, and really, you know, for our nations. What do our nations want for our students when they come out and they graduate?
Sasanesa, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me, and thanking you for really providing light to this topic. I think it's really important for folks who don't understand it and really to think more about, you know, this is just the start of a conversation, and how can we understand this more?
Start of a conversation. Sasanesa Jennings, Native American Student Success Coordinator at the UW System. She's an enrolled member of the Menominee Nation. Just ahead, we talk with a podiatrist about what you need to know to keep your feet healthy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.